the podcast from Belmont Chapel in Exeter, sharing the story, living the life. For more information, go to belmontchapel.org.uk.
My name, as you know, is Coffey, C-O-F-F-E-Y, and Coffey is an Irish name. All four of my grandparents came from Ireland, two from the north, two from the south. And if you know anything about Irish people, they have a romantic disposition. So here I was standing on Victoria Station, 8 o'clock in the morning, and as I stood there waiting for a train, over the loudspeaker came one of Janet's favourite songs. And so I took my phone out and decided to text her. And I just said, "They're playing one of your favourite songs. I love you very much." Signed it, David, and then, in an act of romantic madness, I added two kisses. And I sent the text. And my little heart thought, I'm going to get a text back. But would you believe, nothing. I went on my way. I had to do some lectures in South London and came back. And about 3:30 that afternoon, I was on the train at Paddington. And as I sat on the train waiting for it to go, I had a text. But it wasn't from my wife, Janet. It was from a mate of mine called Steve, who said, "Was this text intended for me? Are you seeking to take our relationship to a deeper level?" This Steve, in fact, was the is the general director of the Evangelical Alliance, Steve Clifford. A text that was intended for Janet's eyes only had gone seriously astray. I have been known to do that. I've really prayed over this weekend that a message intended for Belmont and for you personally, I don't know you, many of you, would not go astray. And I trust that Friday, Saturday morning, Saturday evening have been a preparation ground for where we are this morning. Remember what I said on Friday night, that if you come to Jesus, Jesus sat down and his disciples came to him and he taught them, that if you do that, you are taking a risk if you want to be serious about crowning Jesus as king. Because to come to Jesus and be taught by him, customized teaching, because he knows every one of you. He knows where you are, which school, which university, which course, which workplace, which house. He knows your gifts, he knows your dispositions, he knows your failures. Before a word is on your tongue, he knows it altogether. You can't flee from him, you know, Psalm 139. So I suppose my prayer for the fourth and final time is, Lord, don't let this message go astray. I have a responsibility to discharge, but once I've discharged it, I'm not bothered about people saying, "How did David do?" Because that's not the issue. The issue is how you are doing with the word that you have received. That's the issue of the day. So let's look at these verses. You remember where we're at? We're at the position where we've had eight beautiful attitudes which receive the applause of heaven. And what happens now in these verses is the attitudes go public. The invisible becomes visible. Salt and light. Salt that has to be rubbed in, light that has to shine. And here's the first thing. There are four very basic things I'm going to give you arising from the passage. Number one, God intends us to be... Can we turn the thing on? That's all, no worries. That's all right. You are deep in the word. I could see it. That's a model student. Well done. Thank you very much. Jesus says, "You are the salt of the earth. You are the light of the world." Now, I want you just to sort of, for a moment, think of how incredible this is. Here's Jesus with 12 who are maybe part of 120 who will later become 3,000. But there are fewer people Jesus is talking to than all the Christians put together in Exeter. These people are very few, they are very unimportant, and they have very little influence. Those of you who are historians will know that the Greek Empire is gone and all its civilization, the Roman Empire has come, Persian Empire, all the great civilizations that still have an influence on our art, our law, our commerce and so on, our culture. Persian, Greek and Roman. And not only from the great Rome itself, but in the provinces and in the districts. It was oppressive. As they met, as we are meeting now, there might be soldiers on horseback going around the streets who had the power to tap any citizen on the shoulder and say, carry this a mile. And what did Jesus say? When a soldier who you really hate in your heart does that, don't just do it a mile, which the law requires, take it 2 miles and beyond. It was an unjust system. Luke chapter 19 tells the story of Zacchaeus. Zacchaeus was a mafia member buried in the tax system. He not only empowered himself with wealth, he impoverished the community, which is why it's such a fantastic economic in reverse story, Luke 19, that when he gets saved, the whole town gets blessed economically. So you have an oppressive system, an unjust system, a corrupt system. And Jesus comes and says, I intend you to be salt and light. It's incredible, the more you think about it. These eight beautiful attitudes are to be lived out in an oppressive, cruel, unjust, corrupt world, and you'll make a difference. If you're poor in spirit, if you mourn over your sins, if you're meek and real, if you hunger for righteousness, if you show mercy, if you have a purity of heart, if you're a peacemaker, if you're willing to suffer for all this, these beautiful attitudes will make a difference. The first few verses, 1 to 12, could be summed up as be different. And what we're looking at this morning is make a difference. Be different. The eight beautiful attitudes make a difference. Salt and light. This is the best way to read it. You and you alone. That's the emphasis of the language. You and you alone and nobody else are the salt of the earth. You and you alone and nobody else are the light of the world. Salt has to be rubbed into the wounds of the community. Light has to shine in the dark places of the community. The invisible becomes visible. I'm going to give you, if I can, this morning, just a number of illustrations from a variety of situations where Christians have taken this seriously. And here's the first one. It comes from Sussex. On my travels, I met a group of sixth formers, and this had happened probably the previous year to when I met them. All of them committed Christians, wanting to crown Jesus as king. The majority of them very gifted in the area of drama, so much so that they had secured a place at the Edinburgh Festival. And they were so proud of this. The drama teacher was proud, etc., etc. So they were boasting about how they were going to appear at the Edinburgh Festival. And then their drama teacher, not a Christian, laid before them the script that she felt was appropriate to the culture of the Edinburgh Festival. And when they read it, they had a get-together and they said, we can't do this. It was sacrilegious. It was nothing that they had done in school so far. It was appropriate to the culture of the Edinburgh Festival, and the drama teacher thought this will go down well. So what they did, they came knowing that they were salt and light Christians, and they just said, well, we can't do this. They were passing up the privilege of a lifetime. Some of them may have been so good, I don't know, I haven't seen them recently, to go on into make it a profession, but well, this really put everybody in disarray because they then had to bring up the second team, and the second team were prepared to take up this unsavory script and do it. And so what they did, they got together and said, look, we really want to go to the Edinburgh Festival. Would you allow us to perhaps come up with something alternative? Well, apparently there's not only the main stage, there's the fringe, and there must be the fringe of the fringe, because they managed to find a place in the fringe of the fringe, and they went as salt and light people, and they did their bit at the Edinburgh Festival. They honoured the king, and they entertained the crowds. Here's the second thing. God intends us to be salt and light, but the world needs salt and light. You probably, those at the front, can just see that cartoon. It's a salt cellar being upturned, and there are people just being shaken out of it, and it says, "Pass the salt." Now, those two words, the salt of the earth and the light of the world, earth and world, are interpreted in two ways in the Bible. First of all, in the book of Genesis, the world is interpreted as God created this amazing, beautiful universe. He gave it this wonderful fertility. He saw the beauty in the fertility and he said, that's good. That's one way of understanding earth and world. But there's another way that the Bible talks about earth and world, and that's when earth and world, made by God, designed to go with his grain, when earth and world, in the hands of people who completely ignore God, there is a worldliness which wants to run life without any reference to God. So whenever you read the phrases earth and world, you need to understand, well, now, which is this meaning? Is it meaning the perfect, beautiful, fertile earth and world, or is it meaning the godless, no reference to God, earth and world? Because when the world goes according to its own devices, it is not only prone to moral decay, but everything just begins to disintegrate. No salt and light, people suffer. Communities disintegrate. There's a growth of poverty and inequality and injustice and greed and hatred and above all, spiritual ignorance. Martin Luther King, you know, some of you may have seen the film Selma. He said, no salt and light in a nation, his favorite, one of his favorite phrases. No salt and light in a nation, and you have might without morality and power without compassion. The function of salt is to halt moral decay. It serves as a moral disinfectant. It protects, it preserves, it cures. Light warns and attracts. It shines in the dark places, and it directs people to a safe place. My Irish grandmother, I only knew three of my grandparents. My Irish grandmother lived to the wonderful age of 99 years and 6 months. Mary Willis, she was born in Ireland, but moved at the turn of the 19th into the 20th century to Consort, County Durham. Her husband had come to work at what was then the amazing Consort Iron Company, and my grandma had 9 children. My mother was number 5, and my granddad died in the First World War. He died in the early days of the Battle of the Somme, Thomas Coffey. My grandmother was left in her 50s to raise this family of 9, and as she got older, she was just an amazing woman. She would break limbs regularly, and they would mend her up and patch her up and send her home, and on she went. She nearly reached her 100th birthday. In fact, one day, they took her down with yet another broken limb to the doctor. He said, Mrs. Willis, not you again. He said, you are so healthy. You will never die. We will have to shoot you. I love staying with my grandma because I had privilege of staying with my grandma that I never had when I was at home. We'd have fruitcake on the breakfast table. And if, when it came to a big lunch, you know, she'd put apple pie and everything else on the sideboard, and then, you know, the roast beef would arrive on a Sunday. And she saw me looking at the apple pie, and she says, son, would you like your apple pie before you have your roast beef? That was never offered me at home. Because she, being who she was, she had the understanding it didn't matter which arrived first in the stomach, whether it was apple pie first, followed by. So there was just a lovely freedom. My grandma had no phone. She had no car. And she had no fridge. So I can visibly remember, as a child, seeing her with a huge joint of meat, taking a pile of salt and rubbing that salt into that meat. She was preserving, she was protecting, she was curing. I didn't realize until I was older that I was receiving a visual aid of the gospel. Salt does that. It has a preservative quality. So if God intends salt and light. And if the world needs salt and light, why doesn't the church believe it and practice it? Somebody did a survey, one of the friends of Belmont, Tim Chester. He's done a lot of teaching on this. I don't know whether he's ever been to Belmont, but he's well known to Clive and Derek and myself. And the survey came up with answering the question, if God intends it and the world needs it, why doesn't the church do it? And they came up with 10 reasons, but because it's Sunday morning, I'm only going to give you three. Number one reason why the church seems to not see this: it's preoccupied with its theological disagreements, getting its doctrine right. It's busy about doing good things, but so preoccupied it neglects. Number two reason, apparently, is it's so focused on the return of Jesus, it believes that that is the only hope for the world. So what we have to do is to be faithful in keeping our faith and just say what the Bible word is, Maranatha, quickly, come quickly, Lord Jesus, and rescue us and this world from this mess. And number three is that the world really is just beyond the pale. And all we are called to do is to be separate. Come out from the world, be separate, live in pure communities, and just let God sort the rest out. So one is really busyness, and one is faithfulness, and one is purity. And of course, meanwhile, that's the meaning, I think, of verse 13. The salt loses its saltiness. If you purely focus on being busy and being faithful and keeping pure, then you will lose your saltiness. Because that wasn't intended to be that way. Regularly, just shake it out. Regularly, shine. There's another interpretation of verse 13, salt and light, salt losing its saltiness, and that is that salt in the Old Testament especially, salt and wisdom go together. It's a metaphor. So in other words, live wisely, that's good saltiness, and live unwisely, and you're losing your saltiness. Wisdom makes a difference. You see, we look at the world as we might look at the world every time we pray for the world and say, what a mess. And God looks at the world and says, where's the salt and light? Jan and I were taking a conference. It was not a conference like this. It was a group of about 50 friends who wanted to see the beautiful city of Prague. They loved architecture, they loved music, and so they said, you know, would I come and be their Bible teacher in the mornings? And then we went off and saw Prague. And then in the evenings, we just told testimonies from around the world. And it was a great week. During one of these sessions, I don't know, I think it was more private, that a guy working in the construction industry came up to me and said he wanted to share. His name's Ian. And at that time, he's probably retired now. At that time, he was working on Terminal 5. And he said that he was the only Christian on his board of directors. And what had happened was the order book had begun to slow up and people paying their accounts. The money wasn't coming in. So on a Friday evening, the chairman of the board called them together and said, look, you know, we need some ideas. We can't go on like this. We need an order full book, a book full of orders, and we need money to come in. So think about it over the weekend. Ian went to church for a wedding on the Saturday. And during the wedding, they sang that old hymn, Praise to the Lord the Almighty, the King of Creation, which has the line, who doth prosper thy work and defend thee. So a tiny light bulb went off. But on the Sunday morning, unusually for his church, they sang the very same hymn, Praise to the Lord the Almighty, which includes that line, who doth prosper thy work and defend thee. A bigger light bulb went off. And on Monday morning, when the chairman called the directors together, he just said, any ideas over the weekend? So people began to contribute. They knew Ian was a Christian. And then he had the boldness to say, well, he said, I went to church over the weekend. They all nodded. He said, I went to church twice. They looked impressed. He said, we sang a hymn and it had this line, "Who doth prosper thy work and defend thee?" And he said, forgive me for saying this, but he said, I just felt that that was a word to our company. Nobody laughed. He had integrity, and therefore they took him seriously. 6 months went by, the order books had begun to fill up, the money had begun to flow in, and one day, in a light-hearted moment, the chairman looked at Ian in a meeting and he said, have you been to church recently, sung any good hymns recently? But he had made his mark. The world needs the salt and light of the gospel. The third thing is that the salt and light of the gospel does transform communities. It really does make a difference. I want you to be persuaded of this, because I know the big thing that's coming is, where do I start? Where do you want to be salt and light? But it has such a transforming effect when you begin to think of yourself as salt and light. Not last summer, the summer before, Jan and I were in London and we were attending the opening of the new headquarters of the Evangelical Alliance. It's just behind King's Cross Station. Lovely new offices. And they had invited the Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby, to come and open the offices. And he began by telling us that he hadn't come by car, he had come on the tube. He had got one of his staff with him, both wearing dog collars. And as they walked up behind King's Cross towards the offices, this huge guy across the road obviously clocked Justin Welby, realized who he was, and shouted out, "Oi! I want a word with you." So he reached for his mobile phone and his wallet, and this huge bloke walked across the road, and nobody else around. They wondered what was going to happen. As he got towards them, he reached out his hand. He said, "I want to say thank you." He said, "I've just come out of prison," and Justin told us later, he said, looking at him, he said, "I imagined what he had done 15 years for. But while I was in prison, somebody gave me a Bible and somebody told me the good news about Jesus Christ, and it's changed my life. And I want to say thank you." Salt and light, when it's doing its work, has this transforming power. Salt preserves, salt cures, light attracts. The Old Testament says, the entrance of your word brings light. That's why we're not to hide the light under a cover. For a number of years now, we've lived where we are now for 4 years, five this summer, and previously we'd lived there for 23 years, and everywhere we have been, and I don't say this to cast light on ourselves, I want to draw out, let your good works be seen. Let your light shine. Every place we've lived, we have prayed for our neighbors by name. Well, first of all, we have to find out the name of your neighbors. And I give you a whole talk, and my health warning is, don't pray for your neighbors, because believe me, God hears those prayers and you get involved. And there are times, especially in recent weeks, when we say, well, shall we stop praying? But if you're going to see a community transformed, I can't take on the whole of Devon, but I can take on my street. And it begins with just ordinary human kindness, friendship, plus prayer. I remember reading a long time ago an article published just after John Stott had died, the great theologian preacher, and talked about, you know, what difference can Christians make. It begins with prayer. It begins with truth-telling. Prayer, truth-telling, example. They're not big things. They're within the power of everybody who wants to crown Jesus as king. I could tell you some lovely stories of real things that have happened, real changes that have made, deep friendships that have been formed. You find yourself being bold and actually praying for people. I lived in Torbay. We began to pray, and one day I was at a petrol pump filling up my petrol car, and a guy from the other side said, "Hello." He said, "I'm your new neighbor." I said, "Oh, hello." He says, "My name's Ken. And I said, well, we must get together sometime. So not very long after that, Saturday night, 10:15 at night, 10:30, knock on the door. So we're good Christian people. They say, wonderful, who can that be? Let's go and let them in, you know. Neighbour from across the road, the woman who we hadn't met, she said, my husband's just been rushed into hospital. I need a lift. Take her up there, go into the intensive care ward. There's Ken. Comes to when we come there. And I got my little pocket Bible with me, and I went into my pastoral mode. I said, well, Ken, when I do this, he knows I'm a pastor. I said, I normally pray for people. Can I pray for you? And I had that schizophrenic moment. I'm praying that the Lord would heal this man. And in the other half of the brain, I heard him saying, you have prayed for this road, and this is the beginning of an answer to prayer. I could go on and tell you what happened to Ken. He was restored, he was healed, eventually baptized, he's done missionary work in the Cameroon, nothing to do with me, everything to do with the light of the gospel. I just encourage you, begin there, make a commitment, write it down, put it in the front of your Bible. I'm going to begin by praying for those nearest to me, my family, the block of flats where I live, the students I study with, the people I work with. Don't be too busy. Don't be so faithful. Don't be so keeping the purity that you don't understand what this means. It does transform. When we become a visible church, God has the opportunity to let that salt and light get to work. And Boston in the United States, Dorchester, has always been a very tough area, ridden with drug and crime. And the churches in Boston often used to lift up their hands with despair and say, what can we do? But the turning point came when, with a drug warfare taking place, rival gangs, they burst into a church and they stabbed to death a young guy caught up in the drug warfare. They stabbed him to death on the pulpit steps and he bled to death. And that was the catalyst for bringing the churches together in Dorchester to say, look, Lord, have mercy. And they said, what we've got to do, peacemakers, we've somehow got to meet these drug barons. We've got to sit down with them. So they called a meeting of the drug barons. And they said, the drug barons said, we'll tell you what's going wrong. They said, when children come out of school at 3 o'clock, we're at the school gates and you're not. When parents send their kids down to the shop to buy bread at 5 o'clock, we're there and you're not. At 7 o'clock, when they go out to play on the streets and in the playgrounds, we're there and you're not. And out of that was born, don't ask me how they did it, the 24/7 ministry. Because they wanted to end the pattern of we're there, you're not. And they wanted to be a presence buried in the life of that community. And I suppose I have to say to you in this section, where in Exeter is the light not shining? Where in the places where you live does salt and light need to be buried deep? In order for it to begin to transform the community. Here's the fifth thing. Everyone is called to be a salt and light Christian. You are. You personally are the salt of the earth. You are the light of the world. Every follower of Jesus, everyone who wants to crown him as king, everyone who knows these 8 beautiful attitudes are growing gradually. They're not yet to perfection in any of our lives, but we've put them in place, or we're beginning to put them in place as a community corporately. So if you say to me this morning, David, I have no money, I have no wisdom, I'm not well educated, I have no real position or influence in life, my question to you is, are you crowning Jesus as king? And you say, yes, right. And you're called. I love those Bible stories like in the book of Kings where an unnamed person comes to the chief military commander in the land and just says, I think I know where your skin disease can be healed. We don't even know her name. And there's a number of times like that in the Bible where people are just not named. So no wisdom, no wealth, no influence, you're still called. And let me say to those of you who have all these things, you have lots of wisdom and you have a good position and you are greatly privileged. I hope the Esther principle is operating in your life. The Esther principle, Uncle Mordecai says to his niece, in a very high position, has got the ear of the king, the most beautiful woman in the land. Who knows but for such a time as this, God has brought you to this place. That, my friend, is you. I had to be reminded of that any number of times when for a season in my life, I had great privileges. I could list people that I've met, the great and the good in this land and in many, many other countries. And every time I went in, I had the little prayer, Lord, make this count. Giving Bibles away to pagan kings. Reminding atheist rulers that actually, even if they acknowledged it or not, they were there in the hands of God to bless a nation. So whether you have no influence or lots of influence, everybody is called to be salt and light. We all have spiritual gifts that vary. There is a huge diversity of gifts. Not everybody could stand up here, lead music, conduct Bible studies. Certainly I couldn't plan that amazing, almost it's a knockout last night. Well done, that crew. Brilliant. But salt and light are common to us all. If you have been crowning Jesus as king, then you can make a difference. You begin by saying, Lord, show me. It's a simple prayer you can offer at communion. Just show me, Lord. Show me who, show me how, show me where. Could you do that? I think if you said to me, David, of all the books that were on the bookstall, including one by me, which book would you recommend? Well, it wouldn't be mine. It would be Tim Keller's. It hasn't been reviewed, but for those of you in the workplace, Every Good Endeavor by Tim Keller, connecting your work to God's plan for the world. Brilliant, brilliant examples of what can happen being salt and light in the workplace. He highlights how much corruption and bribery there is around the world. If, like me, you've moved around, and I'm sure it happens, we know it happens in this country, but in parts of the world, it's there all the time. Missionaries who need drugs for the hospitals they're running, but they refuse to pay the high bribery prices, so the drugs remain in customs. And sadly, patients die simply because missionaries say, no, we're crowning Jesus as king. We're not going to get involved in the corruption of this country. Keller makes the point, in this country, I would say to you, you can be commended for not getting involved in that, but he challenges those of us who turn a blind eye. Where this is taking place, we know about it, but do nothing about it. Wake up. He talks about the car salesman who was deeply concerned about the price fixing, which he knew was impoverishing those who were not good at negotiations, and very often they were poor people, single parents, etc. So he stood up. Salt and light was counted for it. They changed the practice. Talks about having a ministry of competence and people who work and make things, how one person had read the book of Genesis and realized that God never made junk. So therefore, I will not make junk. I will make things that are enduring and beautiful and lasting because God does. Quotes Dorothy Sayers, not a great influence on us now, but a huge influence on the 1930s, 40s, and 50s generation. Where she says that we as a church often pray for a skilled carpenter in the wrong way. We say, Lord, may that skilled carpenter come to church every Sunday. May he not get drunk on the job. Whereas in fact, the real prayer for the skilled carpenter is, Lord, may he make excellent tables that everybody wants to buy. He did a survey amongst his many medical people who worked in the medical profession. And he asks them, what is the most difficult challenge that you face? And what are your trials and temptations? And he had some very interesting answers back. Had one person who quoted Dr. Martin Lloyd-Jones, one of our great Bible teachers of an earlier generation, himself a physician. He said, I agree with what Dr. Lloyd-Jones says, that many tombstones will have the epitaph, born a human being, died a doctor. And the temptation, said another, for medicine is to take over your life and rule your life as an enslaving power. It's a subtle one. Because it's a kind of moral ego massage, because you're giving so much to do so much good. There's a lot of self-justifying power in that kind of idolatry. Much easier to feel morally superior as a doctor than as a stockbroker. Another person wrote, it's easy to become extremely cynical about people and emotionally hardened to life. You see so much messy stuff of life and death that you have to have a defense mechanism to become emotionally detached and keep a distance in order to maintain your sanity. Another one talked about the traits of pride and cynicism and detachment. And one said, in the early days of a medical career, you work such long hours that prayer life dries up, it becomes deadly. I've had to learn that only if Jesus stays real to the heart can you go on being consistently joyful in him, making your medicine calling something full of self-worth. Lord, prevent me from becoming hardened when I am surrounded by so much ingratitude. Do your own survey. Support those in the workplace who are seeking to be salt and light. Salt and light, God intends it. The world needs it. It makes a difference, and everyone's included. Another book that was recommended was David Cook's The Unheeded Christ. You'll need that because it's really a wonderful exposition of the whole of Matthew. He doesn't concentrate so much on the passages we've been looking at, but from now on in, as you make your journey through Matthew as Belmont, David Cook, Australian Bible teacher, The Unheeded Christ. And at the end of one of his chapters, he says how, some of you may do this, in the front of his Bible, he keeps various things. A family photo that's a bit out of date, a favourite hymn, a letter from the Sydney Morning Herald letters page. He doesn't say what it is. But then he said, I've written down these words. When I reach the end of my days, a moment or two from now, I want to look back on something more meaningful than just the pursuit of a house and land. I want to consider my earthly existence not to have been wasted. I want to remember a loving family, a consistent involvement in the lives of people, and an earnest attempt to serve the God who made me. Because nothing else makes much sense. I suppose a little challenge to you would be to take a bit of paper and say to the Lord, Lord, what you've said to me this weekend about these 8 beautiful attitudes which receive your applause and you want to make them visible in this world through me. Write it down and put it in the Bible. And every now and again, take it out and say to the Lord, how am I doing? Rosie has written a poem about salt and light, and she's going to come and read it to us as her response to what we've heard.